Okay. Excuse me. In this last session, we're looking at the question of the Reformation today, which is, I wouldn't say it's the easiest question to address, in the sense of, what do you mean by today? What do you mean by, is there a Reformation today? And I want to sort of go back to the previous session, just pick up one thread, because it's going to be important as this lecture carries on, which is that this country, and much of North America at least, is founded by the intersection between what I was describing in our last hour as pietistic evangelicalism, which is very much emotions, very much resistance to things like confessions or creeds, etc. More on that in a second. And then if you know a little bit about our history, you might have thought during last lecture, well, what about the Puritans? They don't sound like these descriptions that you have. And they don't in some ways, though they do take on some of this over time. What I would say is, if you want to understand this country, you have to understand how these two interplay. These are oil and water in some way, both sides. But what ends up happening is your experience and my experience in most denominations, even denominations that would be far more Puritan than not, will still have pietistic elements that have come in. So what do I mean? Well, on the Puritan side, you have a lot of core values and instincts that are certainly more traditional, more old world. Okay, so you have things like an educated clergy and laity. This is why you have a conference in the middle of a church. This is why you would actually care about hearing these types of things. This is why you have a book table. You don't find book tables at lots of churches, put it that way. Or if you do, they're certainly not the kind of books where one is learning more things and taking them in. The Puritan side is not phobic to the question of learning, in other words. The Puritan side as well is self-consciously confessional. Now, I'm going to have something to say on that in a minute. That language of confessionalism has changed a bit lately, in the last 100 years or so, and we need, I think, to flesh it out a bit more. But it is at least self-consciously concerned about the essentials and the identity of their community and what it believes. You know, in a Presbyterian context, it would be the Westminster Standards, and certainly with other denominations. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. I don't know about you guys, but when my kids go back to school, they're basically little petri dishes. So they bring the germs home, and they get over the cold in 2 days, and it takes me like 2 months to get it out of my system. My throat has been bothering me for a while, though. But anyway, but confessionalism, the Puritan confessions, this language is a Puritan instinct. Now, Puritan, of course, isn't synonymous with any denomination. It's more of a broad stream over 300 years. So there's lots of different confessional identities. But one of their main instincts is towards Calvinism. Again, different appropriations of it, but the Puritan instinct is certainly Calvinistic. At its practical level, though, it is covenantal. It cares about units of interactions, family, the church, and the wider community. The questions of homeschooling or classical education, the language of our covenant community together, or our involvement with the world around us, is all run through the language of covenant. It's all run through this idea that what we care about is not just me, myself, and I, even though we're raised in that world and it's still part of our identity in some ways. You can't avoid it. Nevertheless, our instinct is towards the unit, the covenant, the generational language. That side is certainly a part of this country, certainly a part of this nation. Strangely enough, though, this nation has also incorporated a pietistic side that seems contradictory or at least counterintuitive to the Puritan side. And that pietistic side is emotional. Now, I say here, be careful. We don't want to make it sound like Puritans are non-emotional. But it's more of the idea that the emotions is the core of where your Christian faith lands. It's not that they're pro-emotions and the other is not, but rather they are exclusively emotional as the lead principle in one's Christian formation. The language of, I have to feel a certain way day by day, that kind of thing. Certainly more immediate. The pietistic side is where you get things like no creed but the Bible, which, you know, there's actually a book on the table, The Creedal Imperative by Truman, which demonstrates this. He, coming from the more Puritan side, he will say, it's very strange to be anti-confessions, anti-creeds, when the churches that say they have no confessions or creeds, often the churches that will throw you out for not believing certain things specifically related to confessional or creedal identity. So you can't avoid it, but nevertheless, there's this instinct of immediate faith, sort of an anti-liturgical, anti-confessional sense. It has to be always heartfelt, immediate, experiential. They tend to be Arminian-leaning, or as I say, they just don't care, which usually means they're Arminian. And the Arminian side here is the relationship to the free will and that type of thing, which we didn't get into at all yet. We really can't for the sake of time. But the default position for evangelicals being individualistic in general, if you're not from a Puritan stream, you're going to be pretty much in the Arminian side, which is I have decided to follow Jesus. Meaning, I always tell my students, Calvinists can sing, I have decided to follow Jesus. You have decided to follow Jesus. It's just the Holy Spirit has come and taken the scales, given you a heart of flesh, and has restored you so that you want to follow Jesus. The I have decided to follow Jesus song is problematic when it's I have decided. It's my strength that has led me to decide this. That's when it starts to have a problem. And of course, it's individualistic. I cannot rectify these sides, but American evangelicalism somehow makes it work. If there's, you remember the old show, The Odd Couple? This is the theological odd couple. And it is what makes American evangelicalism work. With my students, when I'm going through this, I always stop and say, this is why you have some family and friends who, when you said, I'm going to seminary, they said, hoorah, go get it. And you have another half of your friends that said, ew. Why would you do that? You can't rectify it, but you have both of them in your life. And you have both of these streams. Increasingly, at least in the 21st century, I should say, scholars are noticing that there is a learning from the other side more between these two groups. So traditional denominations or non-denominational larger churches that might have never darkened the door of seminary, might never have cared about confessions or anything like that, are increasingly saying, we need to get our heads on straight here. We need to think theologically and be more reflective. And those who would be reactionary against some of that stuff have learned to not throw the baby out with the bath and not embrace anti-emotionalism or some of those things as well. They're not as... I wouldn't paint these as enemies. Rather, again, it's just two entirely different streams from Europe come together, and in this context, they mix in a way that had never mixed before. I mean, if you were pietist in the old world, you were just German Lutheran, and you happened to be in one of those churches. If you're up in Scotland, you have no connection to that stuff. Here, though, we do, which is why even churches that are in a Puritan model have Sunday schools, which is an invention of pietism. We have small groups, which is an invention of pietism. These things mixed. So what that means is that the founders of American Christianity, in our experience, have brought things together, or things have just happened to come together by being neighbors with folks in a way that had never happened before. Now, is this important for global Christianity in the 21st century? Yes, because this is our chief theological export around the world. And you're going to see this as I walk through this. What Protestantism and evangelicalism has done is ship this type of perspective to much of the other parts of the world. Now, it doesn't mean we're the dominant voice in those worlds, but Pentecostalism, which is very much in the pietistic side, is global. But so is also Puritan movements as well. They mix differently in other cultures and other worlds. And so what we've begun to see is that some of this is changing, and some of our flaws don't happen in other countries. Rather, sometimes other flaws happen, and we learn from those. So we live in an amazing age, just put it that way. What we know, what's happening around the world, and as we see Christianity expand, Protestantism go around. It's amazing. So the Pilgrims of the New World, of course, I always say the Thanksgiving story of the Puritans coming, that's just one piece of the story. Because also with them were coming Anabaptists and others, Pietists and Lutherans. I mean, just go to Pennsylvania and you will see all the areas where Anabaptists and Pietists and all these folks landed. One of the places, I should say. From the very beginning. Now, this global question is what I want to end us on because it really is the glass half full story. If we ended on the great disappointment last time, this is really the great optimism as global Christianity continues to expand, as we're seeing these things. The globalization question happened almost immediately in the context of the Reformation. This is the Treaty of Tordesillas, which happened in the late 1400s. Of course, we can all remember 1492, Columbus did something, sailed the ocean blue, there we go. And very shortly after that, the Pope made a treaty. He issued a command, the Treaty of Tordesillas. And that, you see it right here. There's a line that bisects the globe, and it just so happens to bisect Portugal, or at least a portion of modern-day Portugal, on the right-hand side, and to the left is, in the red, the Spanish side. Did you ever wonder why Brazil speaks a different language than the rest of South America? It's a papal decision. He split a line right up the middle, and he said, Portuguese, you can have everything this half of the globe. Spanish, you may take all this side over here. And, of course, you see where the Spanish moved up into. They moved up into this country. It's why all of our city names are very often of Spanish origin, though we've anglicized it over the years, that kind of a thing. Like Leon County, that's what I always grew up calling it. Leon County, it's Leon County, it's Leon, or it's the Spanish equivalent of it. I said it in the French way, but whatever. But all the Spanish territories, all that is taken. From the very beginning, there is a global rush between Catholics and Protestants. And what happens is the Spanish take all the areas up there. The Portuguese, because they're focused on parts of Africa around the coast, more on that in a minute, or out towards Asia, they do not connect with colonial America very quickly. But you should notice that the Spanish are the first to come to this country and to try to take it as a Catholic nation. A lot of the grievous stories of Catholic missionaries force converting or force baptizing folks come from that phase. Some of you might have seen the movie The Mission. De Niro and Irons, Jeremy Irons, I think it is. It's a powerful movie. I mean, the opening scene is a Jesuit missionary being crucified and thrown into a river. And it's in the South American, I forget which country it is, but it's in South America. And you have a big rush that goes up that way. Spain, though, begins to contract and lose power. They start to pull back, and they lose the north margin the most. They can't keep track of it very well. They're strongest down south. That, by the way, is why the Caribbean area, the Buccaneer regions, all those pirate movies that you see every other year, the reason why that it's such a wild, wild west of the seas is because that's where Spain once controlled, and as they pull back, pirates come in trying to seize all the sugar and all the other types of money as well. France comes in next. Of course, France is Catholic. So at the end of the day, what has happened is you have the Spanish and the French taking the North American context, and that is why the Puritans come rushing to this country. I remember being part of my son, now he's in first grade. When he was in pre-K, he had a Thanksgiving show that we went to see. It was awful. I mean, the kids didn't deliver their lines correctly. They didn't believe their part. You know, they were just kind of just going through the motions and stuff. But the anxiety of a historian is you watch these things, and there's always a thought in your head going, that's not what happened. That's not what happened. That's not what happened. But you're not going to be a son. I'm sorry, but that's not true. But what ends up happening is the story that they portrayed in a silly way, and it was cute. It was deadly cute. But they portrayed this scene where these kids would hold Bibles, and this guy that had King James written across his shirt would come up and pretend whack him in the head and steal their Bible. And then they got on a boat and pretended to go across the sea. And I just remember my wife, and I said, I hate my head. It just can't shut up when I see that. And she said, what happened? I said, King James, the King James Bible, he's stealing their Bibles? Like he actually funded the creation of an English Bible. I said, he didn't destroy it. And then the other piece, and this is why I raise it, is they didn't run away from him. He actually paid for the pilgrims to come to this world. It was a funded royal decree. Why, though? Well, the reason was because they were not going to be allowed to do church their own way back in the home country, back in England. And the king had a problem on his hands. And so what he said is, hey, you know what? We've really got to get to the New World, or we're going to be eclipsed by the entire Catholic Church as it goes all the way around the world. He says, how about this? We'll pay for you to go there and to found colonies that will then increase trade back with us. And while you're there, you can worship as you please. That it was actually a royal charter that allowed for this. What ended up happening, though, is you get a picture like this. The Spanish are being pulled back. They're not having as much strength. The French take all the middle regions. This is why you have Louisiana, all these very French names up and down that corridor. St. Louis, for example, those names. And then, of course, the Brits just barely make it onto the eastern seaboard, and they hold on tight. And the rest, of course, is the expansion of that British colonial empire after it leaves the Brits and founds itself in melting pots, all this stuff together. What that means, then, is all these instincts were shipped here and they mingled. Now, as I've said, they're going around the world. And they're taking on different instincts and different problems and different strengths as it happens. And this should be enormously encouraging to you, I think, as you see it. There's going to be some stuff that I'm going to mention that isn't pretty, apartheid, things like that, that are going to come up. But the reality is as Christianity has gone global, it's learned what not to do and how to engage. And what the Protestant world has learned is where its strengths are and where they can give up things. Because the problem was, is when we came to the colonial world and we founded these United States, it became very common within about two generations to assume that this is how church had always been done everywhere. That you had a Methodist church and a Baptist church and a Catholic church and all these churches all side by side and not trying to kill each other. And that there were all these differences of perspective. But that is not the case, historically. But as we've shipped these around the world, what we've heard back from the world are the ways in which our culture has married into our theology, that when we then go take our theology to another culture like Korean Presbyterianism, they say, well, we don't do it that way. We don't act, that's not us. We're still Presbyterian, we're still Reformed, but we're not that way culturally. And we realize, oh, that's just us. You're right, that is our culture. That's the world we live in. So we're actually getting an echo back, a response back from the global church as it reminds us what it means to be essentially Protestant, essentially Reformed, rather than to be simply a majority culture that's always assumed that this is how it always is. I always say you learn as much about who you are by defining who you are as well as learning what you're not. And you learn, I'm actually not like that. It's actually a positive for you. And that's what we've had in the global situation. So Protestantism in this world is shaped by two things. Two things. First is where Protestants are going. Where Protestants are going. This, by the way, is largely what I teach for Crusade. This is where a lot of this is coming from. Of course, Crusade is all over the world. It's like the Chinese army in terms of how many people they have everywhere. They just do everything everywhere. It's the largest Christian organization in North America, and potentially the world. I can't remember off the top of my head. But this came from a realization within the culture of Capus Crusade that they wanted to know more about the global story, because all they knew was the North American story. Then they land in another part of the world, and they don't know what they're looking at. And so it's been an enormous refreshment for me as well to realize that global Christianity is staggering from a historian standpoint. For the Protestant story as it goes around the world is staggering. Because we started in the 1500s in just Europe, it became easy, I think, within Protestantism to only associate ourselves with that point till now. Meaning we mentally, at least practically, cut ourselves off from the first 1,500 years of the church. David Steinmetz is a professor, was a professor at Duke. He passed away several years ago. He used to joke, he's a Reformation scholar, he used to joke that for Protestants, the light goes off right about the time of Augustine, and it only comes back on again when Luther descends from the heavens with a beer in one hand, singing "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And he said that everything in between, a millennia no less, is lost to us. And he would say, you know, that the unfortunate thing is, to use my language, that makes us functionally Mormon. It makes us believe that the church didn't really exist until we came. But I think it's more just a bit of amnesia. We forget the history before. We don't identify with it as much as we ought to. What's happened because of that, though, is we only our story of Protestantism has largely tended to be, here's us in Europe and here's us in North America. But what has happened with the global story is a revolution of that thinking and a return back to the global church that it always was. We are living right now, for example, in the most rapid change of the Christian faith demographically than we've ever seen in the entirety of its history. For example, if you were to go to 1800 and say, okay, what is the headcount of Christians? And of that headcount, what percentage lives in which of the continents? Let me make sure you get that stat. This is just a headcount of Christians. We're not asking what kind of Christian. We're not asking are they even really good examples of Christians. And of course, there's certainly going to be people that are culturally identifying as such. And we're dealing with Catholics as well as Protestants. But this is important to see the big picture. But in 1800, if you tallied up tallied up the total of all the headcount of Christians, the percentages of the country look like this. 85% are living in the country, in the European regions of the total headcount. 3% only are living in North America. That's because it's 1800, it's just after 1776. You really only have the colonies and a bunch of empty land heading out towards California. That's overstating it, but you know what I mean. 8% in South America, 1% in Africa, and 3% in Asia. Now, that doesn't mean that there were squalid numbers of Christians in Africa and Asia. This is a time when Europe was incredibly dense with population. I mean, millions upon millions of people living in the greater London area, for example, just by themselves. And so you'll have a large number of Christians by number. If you saw the number, it would be in the millions. But in Africa and Asia, but the overall percentages, that's only 1% to 4% total combined between them. But I think this gives you the impression that we are very one-focus, Eurocentric, is what they often say. But this is an aberration. Hold on a second. If you did the same study in 2016, and you were to ask, again, take all the headcount and then break it up according to percentages, it looks like this. Now, in terms of time, that might feel like a long time ago, 1800. Historically, it's not. And for it to shift this fast is a staggering work of God. I don't tend to providentialize history or stats or figures, but I do think God is always at work. But he would be at work even if it was not quite this rapid. But this is staggering, and it ought to be appreciated that the sheer numbers of folks around the world have moved, as I say, to the global south. Now, the thing most people are shocked about first is that there's still 25% in Europe. The European church is not as dead as everyone says it is. Certainly the 25% would include Catholics, but the Catholic church is emptying out there as well. But, I mean, when I lived in Cambridge, I studied in Germany for a year, I lived in Rome. I mean, at least in the German and British context, you couldn't swing your backpack without hitting an evangelical. They were everywhere. They don't have mega churches. That's an American phenomenon. You need lots of land to build a mega church, and they don't have that as much in Europe. But there were plenty of Christians and committed Protestants everywhere I went. But the 25% is strong. The 15% in Asia is the fastest rising number. It was probably about 8-9% back in the late 90s, something like that. But to flatten out the globe like this that fast is just simply staggering. That what we're looking at is what I would call a re-globalization of the church. A re-globalization, meaning when you ask the question, is Christianity global? From an historian standpoint, I think the Reformation, we start in 1500 and move forward, we forget how much the church was global until roughly the late Middle Ages. The church was always global. For example, first couple centuries, naturally, you're looking at the Semitic regions, the Palestinian regions, as we call it today, the Near East, however you want to call it. This is just the first, this is at time of Christ up into the first apostolic fathers. Very quickly, it expands out. It starts to move. Yes, by the way, there is a dot down here in India. There are indications of early conversion and churches in India as back this early. But by and large, you're looking at North Africa, Southern Europe, as we call it today, and the Near East. This continues to expand to the point that by 800 AD, this is the coronation of Charlemagne time, you are looking at what is, to them, a truly global church. Now, to us, this isn't global. This seems very restricted. But we can forgive them for not knowing there's a new world out there, okay? They didn't know it existed. They also, by the way, did not know what really existed below the Sahara Desert. I mean, it is, with modern technology and machinery, it's virtually impossible to cross it sometimes. You can imagine if all you had was camels and those types of things. Very, very difficult. All they knew is above the Sahara and then up into northern, increasingly northern Europe. And you'll see the dots out here on the right. Scholars have found all types of evidence that there is Christianity exploding out further in the Far East all throughout these centuries. For example, we know that there were Christian churches that numbered 30 to 40% of the populace in Japan in the early part of the Middle Ages. A later Japanese king threw them out and persecuted them to oblivion, so that now we only know Japan as non-Christian or historically unchristianized. But it would be the same as saying that for us today, when you look at North Africa and the Near East, we do not think of them as heavily populated with Christians. That's where Christianity was birthed, y'all. That's where we came from. So the idea that we have only been European focused all this time is actually more recent than most of church history. It's by 1100 that all of those areas, particularly Far East, Near East, and North Africa, they're not eradicated, but they are crushed. They are crushed through the rise of Islam, the expansion across the North African regions, up into Spain even. And it's crushed in places out east as well. There are staggering numbers of Chinese Christians, as we would know. It's not a nation of China yet, but in the area of modern-day China, there are lots of Christian churches in that age up until about this time. So much so that if you were to, there's this woodcut, famous woodcut, now, 1568, that was made by someone in Germany. 1568, of course, is after Luther. It's Luther's already passed on. Calvin's died by this point. And so you're talking about third-generation Reformation time. And he sat down to make a carving of the Christian church in the world. And here we are in Germany, and he draws three petals. The center of it is Jerusalem, and then he has Europe, Asia, and Africa. So that by 1568, they know that they are one-third of the church. Of course, the New World is, figure out at that point, but he doesn't quite draw it in there. Four petals might have messed up the balance, I guess. But nonetheless, he understands that he is one-third. He understands that he's never met an African or an Asian Christian. He doesn't have the capacity. He doesn't have Skype. He can't talk to them. But he knows they're out there. And the technology piece would only increase over the years. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that the church had always been global, and it had been lost from the Middle Ages until just prior to the Reformation. So what the reality is as the church goes global now, we're actually rediscovering these portions of who we are. We're learning that it is a challenge, but we're also learning that it's quite exhilarating when so many missionaries go to other parts of the world and share the faith, and we see that explosion of the numbers of Christians. So let me walk you through an example of this. When you look at Christian, Protestant, and I will add Catholic into this mix, the involvement in Africa over the centuries. Now, I already said that from almost the very beginning, the African church was incredibly strong. Today, we would call this the Nubian church or the Ethiopian branch of the church. What you have to realize is that from about 150 AD, which is the second, third generation of post-apostolic times, from that point until the year 700, North Africa is the Bible Belt. That's how you have to think of it. Just like the Bible Belt here, you have cultural Christianity right alongside authentic, true Christianity. And both sides can inspire one another to being hardcore, militant, and strong in their faith. You still have things in the southern culture that you won't find in other parts of this country. That's North Africa. I mean, the Donatist controversy, which is one of the early church controversies, is basically a ultra-precise, if you're not good enough to be one of our pastors, if you stumble ethically and morally, eventually you will be removed permanently and even called not a Christian at some point. I mean, that's rock-ribbed, hardcore type stuff. They're not the lazy ones. But by 700 to 1900, you have an incredibly slow collapse of the majority of North African Christianity. Slow. Very, very, very slow. And not permanent, and not entirely, but slow. For example, we have only fragments of evidence as to what's happening. None of this, by the way, is sub-Sahara. But the churches as late as the 1000s we know are all throughout North Africa. We know they're there. We know, for example, from Vatican records that there are bishops in North Africa as late as the 1300s. You don't have a bishop if you don't have other churches that they are administrating over. We know of Berber Christianity, which is between modern-day Egypt and Morocco. It's in that region and there, between those at least. Berber Christianity in the 1400s. When missionaries and explorers landed in the 19th century in North Africa, though, they found very, very little evidence of that Christianity because it had been largely lost, particularly as you moved west across North Africa. Now, you have to realize, it wasn't entirely lost. Again, sorry, that's black. This should be white. That was a typo. But if you can't read it, it says African Christianity survives in Egypt and Ethiopia. The problem is we don't tend to think of Egypt and Ethiopia as part of Africa because we tend to, I mean, geographically it is, but we think of Egypt as leaning more towards the Middle East, just over the Red Sea there. But the reality is all these areas have historic Christianity. Some of which probably go back there's the Ethiopian eunuch, even perhaps to the time of the apostles themselves. The one year I was teaching down at RTS Orlando, a student of mine is from Egypt. And I was walking through this and some other things, and she said, she came up to me afterwards, she said, you have to realize, a lot of these countries, a lot of these areas, Iran, Libya, all these areas that you could think of that we would consider today to be inhospitable places for Christianity, for most of the history up until, say, the mid-1900s, early 1900s, there was actually a significant number of Christian peoples there until they were thrown out in the 20th century. The oppression, in other words, is very, very recent. The Armenian genocide is actually the word that gave us, that coined the phrase genocide. 1 million of our brothers and sisters were slaughtered or starved. In the area of modern-day Turkey. So she just said, you have to realize Egyptian, Coptic, and engaging with the Ethiopian church, she said, we always try to identify as we've always been here, we're not going anywhere. Yes, we're suffering, but we've been here longer than them, is the way she said it. She's the pluckiest, most awesome lady I've ever met. And she just said, but so many have left. Locally, my campus, Gordon Conwell, we have a board of advisors. The chair of our board is Lebanese. And he would say that Lebanon, the area where he came from, his people left during these revolutions. He was part of the Christian faith. They came. They've been here for so very long. And you hear lots of stories like that. See, I don't want to paint the picture that African Christianity is eradicated. But the main issue right now, as we found it, is the issue of what we call the 10th parallel, which is right there. It's right below the Sahara. The 10th parallel is the radical thing. See, when you and I think of African Christianity or African problems, we forget it's a continent. We think it's like, you know, Mayberry and very small. But it's a massive land. But that line there, to the north of it, is predominantly Muslim. To the south of it is overwhelmingly, sometimes as much as 90%+ Christian. So if you go to Nigeria and other places, you're going to find overwhelming Christian presence, overwhelming Protestant presence. To the north, of course, you're going to find overwhelming Islamic presence. And of course, I have the two black dots there to represent the places of Egyptian or Ethiopian, Nubian presence. That line, by the way, right in the middle, is where all the stories come from. That's where Boko Haram is. That's where the Sudan wars are. All that region is where the two sides are meeting. That's why there's so much conflict, is you have a turf war, you might say, between either side. So if you go further south into the inland southern regions of Africa, you're not finding that stuff at all. If you go to the north, you're finding a far more inhospitable environment to Christian missions or those types of things. And so that's a massively... it's a massive challenge, I should say. Very quickly, the Protestant mission to these regions, though, began in earnest, but we learned something in this. This is why I'm dwelling on this, more as a case study of what we're seeing. I can't tell you the story of the whole globe at once, but I use this as a case study. The first missionaries to Africa were Protestant. In fact, this is him here. His name is Samuel Crowther, and there is dates, 1809, 1891. He was part of the Wesleyan movement. Now, why was he Wesleyan? How do you become Wesleyan when you're from Africa? Well, he was actually caught, captured, and put on a slave ship. And he was on the way across the ocean, and the British captured the ship, and they had outlawed slavery by this time. And they brought the slaves back to England, and they freed them there. He is then brought into a home, he's taken care of, and he's then given a theological education by Wesleyans who were diehard committed against slavery from the very beginning. John Wesley is hands down, he said, it is the worst offense against humanity, it should never have happened. And he should be praised for that, frankly. It's always forgotten the stances he took, and he tried to get rid of it in this country, but no one would listen to him. But in this case, the Wesleyans say, okay, we're going to take someone like Samuel and give him a theological education. And Samuel was enormously helpful and became a committed Wesleyan pastor, Protestant, of that holiness tradition, pietist tradition we're talking about. He goes back to Africa, goes back to his aunt, goes back to his lands in the area of Nigeria. And he develops eventually this language that is now synonymous with global missions, which is the three-self ideal. The three-self ideal becomes that you need to be self-governing, self-supporting, and self-propagating. That if everything has to come to you, whether it's pastors or supplies or whatever, then you're not self-sustaining, and it will be only shallow-rooted fruit that comes out of that. And so he says, well, this has to happen. And he does very, very much, does a lot of work, I should say, in this. The problem is as he gets old in life, he starts to, you know, it happens. The sands of time, they don't flow up. And he begins to sort of not be as strong and as with it as he once was. And the Wesleyan societies, well-intentionedly, come in to try to help. And they essentially replace him. It wasn't aggressive, but it was this idea of, hey, why don't you, let's just hang out over here. We're gonna help out. And they took over. Almost immediately, the Nigerian mission failed. It was seen as a takeover. It was seen as a disrespect of the three-self ideal. And as a result, after only 100 years, it completely collapsed. And what that taught us, essentially, over the years, is that when it comes to the spread of Protestants and Protestant missionary work, and as we've just sort of seen it happen, and as we've learned the hard lessons at times, is that we've realized how much of our cultural identity we're bringing with us, how much of that we're trying to impose, maybe in a Nigerian context or whatever it might be, that what happened then in the 1960s and 70s when you have the African freedom movements, the independence movements of those nations, moments when South Africa comes out from under apartheid and you have all those types of things. And that's just one of the stories you could tell throughout Africa, that what you end up having is the following. You go from 6% growth in population from the early 1900s until now, but you have a 50% growth in the Christian population through the conversion of large families and widespread evangelism as a result of the more increased devotion to this three-self ideal. Which, to just put it simply, means we're not. It's better to support good pastors locally in those environments than to merely always ship our pastors to them. Now, it has to be a bit of both, of course. It depends on the context, depends on the need. And there, I'm not saying anything about global Christianity or global missions. What I'm saying is what we've learned is we've got to be more help than replacement. And Africa is the place where we learn this the most. What this has ended up doing, though, let me move ahead, sorry, here, is that you have a graph like this. This is to sort of see it. That in the 1970s, the millions of converts to Christianity sub-Sahara is just staggeringly skyrocketing as a result. That the language of imposition of we have come from another country to tell you how to believe is always coded as we are the colonializers who are really here to make you subservient so that you do what we say. But when one of their, and this is true, by the way, of almost every country and every missions and everything else, is that when you support those in those communities, whether it's a micro community like a local area in Jacksonville, whether it's a global situation like Africa, it actually begins to radically shape the way things change. What does that mean? That means that what we're witnessing is a change in language and a change in focus in the terms of Protestant history. In our world, North America, if we were to say, what is the difference between Pentecostal and Protestant, you and I would understand that to be the difference between worship style, gifts of the Spirit, all the Azusa Street stuff. Well, there is no Azusa Street in Africa, so they don't identify through that matrix. What we've found, though, is that the language has changed to where now they're going to say Pentecostal, and by that they might mean not the white oppressing Protestants that came and that did that for so long. This is especially the case in South Africa, where the word Pentecostal doesn't necessarily mean charismatic gifting or that as its only focus. And in fact, there might very well be Protestants who are charismatic leaning in that way. But rather, the language of Pentecostal has come to mean we cannot be like Protestants. That change used to freak missionary folk out. They didn't know how to quite deal with it when it first began to happen. But that language is a bit like the way we say, that if I were to say, well, that's a mainline and this is an evangelical church, you would know exactly what I meant and I'm implying by that. That this is a church that is Protestant in name but may not, you know, believe much of anything other than, let's keep the building going. That kind of thing. Or at least some version of there's problems versus evangelical. Whereas historically, evangelical didn't mean the difference between mainline. So again, what's happening is we're seeing a shift and a spasming of questions that we never would have thought as much of in our own context. If you go shift quickly to South America and what we call the evangelical Christianity, the new rise of an evangelical ethos, a focus in South America. Now, this is not the case that South America has never had Protestant globalization or connection there. A good friend of mine from Cambridge is a Presbyterian. He's Brazilian. He's gone back to Brazil, and he has worked very, very tirelessly at the Presbyterian Church and its strength and its witness there. The Presbyterian witness, the Calvinistic witness in Brazil is quite strong. But if you go to different countries, it is different. Due mainly to the fact that the Christian witness, often through the Catholic witness, through the Catholic Church, were the oppressors. They absolutely, in many countries, were the oppressors, either themselves directly, or they were turning a blind eye to the very obvious political oppression, the squalor of some of these countries at times. The wage gap or the earnings gap between the upper middle class and the poor is the steepest in South America than it is anywhere else. I mean, you go from basically you have all the food on the table in the house to cardboard, like horrible squalid living in some countries, some regions, depends. But we're now seeing a change, but it's the same type of problem. Protestant and Pentecostal language, in countries is always prone to different readings. So take Argentina. They would claim to be 2% Protestant but 10% Pentecostal. In our world, that would actually be one stat. You'd say 12% Protestant, because Pentecostal will be a variety of Protestant, we might say, or a denominational trend. In this context, no, it is actually a rejection of the opulence or the strength of established churches. If you go to Brazil, Pentecostal was much, much higher. Colombia, strikingly, much less Protestant or Pentecostal presence. Guatemala is, again, back up on the higher scale. Mexico, much, much lower. The places where it's much lower will be still overwhelmingly culturally Catholic, at least, if not committedly so. So put it this way, the Pope ain't going to Guatemala. He's going to go to usually Mexico or a place where there is a significantly more, plus 90% affiliation with the Catholic Church. So these are just vignettes. These are just stories. We could go on and on and on. And I'm up against the clock, of course, but I want to make sure that you realize that what we're learning in this is a couple things. One is that in this country, there are cultural markers of what it means to be Protestant. That there is even some of the jokes we might make about ourselves. We sometimes can joke about Presbyterians, you know, we can't clap unless Jesus comes back. It has to be that level of good for it to be a reason for us to clap. We make fun of ourselves. We have these cultural identities, and that's just a silly one, but we have also ways of engaging with one another that is very much coded in this country. That doesn't mean that theology is. It means just the way that we interact with each other. What we've thankfully begun to learn is that is both something we can cherish and something we can hold more lightly. In this country, it's happened that as there's been a rise of other non-majority culture Christians within the Protestant Reformed world, we're learning, oh, there are things that we do, we act like that, we have to learn from and interact with and understand those things. In other words, we're learning what is essentially truly Protestant and what is just happens to be the case of North American Protestantism. And that is a good thing to be discovering. Because I dare say, if you go back to the colonial age, they would not have been as aware openly of what happens globally and those types of things. Lastly, the second thing, as we move, looking back again at this country and what usually is going on in our world, what we believe. This is, it's not an issue, but it's a thing that I really want to champion. So I think it's one of the reasons why I'm writing a book on creeds and confessions. Which is that, how are we to understand the past and the theology of the past? You see, because typically the way it's understood is symbolized in this piece of art. If you've been to Geneva, you've seen this. If you go to Geneva, you should go see it. It's the Reformation Wall. These very imposing statues. I mean, it's from just an artistic standpoint, I think it's amazing. I love that kind of stuff. It looks very lifelike. It's Farrell, Calvin, Beza, and Knox, four of the many band of brothers, as I call them, of the Reformed faith. And there they are. But what I don't like about this is the way it could be understood as if they are towering giants that stand over against and in front of us. What is concerning to me about the way we look at our past is that eventually the standards become tribunals, as if they are our judge. And that's a negative way of saying that we put them on pedestals as if the original sin didn't touch them exactly ever. Then we find out some story about Jonathan Edwards or some story about Luther or Calvin, and it shakes the foundation because we have put them up on pedestals as the ones who judge us that way. What I have begun to say, the way I try to describe it, I've already mentioned it before, is that the Reformation is not our judge theologically. Rather, they are brothers. That the Bible is in front of us. They stand shoulder to shoulder, metaphorically, with us. And they point to the Bible and say, don't forget this. Don't forget this. And don't forget this. Meaning that they are colleagues. We're all sinners, and they are too. And that means that those times when we hear stories of the tragedies of history where people that were supposed to be good people end up saying something dumb, doing something dumb, or just whatever. These could be anything big or small. What you then say is, you should have known this in the scripture as well. You're capable of critiquing a colleague, not a tribunal that stands over against you. That what ends up happening is the way the past is used, and I've seen this incessantly in some churches, not so much live church in the sense of everyone's always yelling about this. But I especially saw this when I started this YouTube thing. The number of people that just punch each other up and down, just the rhetoric of, you have abandoned what Calvin said, and this is kind of a hostile attack on things. It becomes this, I have a tribunal attack that if you differ with this person, that what ends up happening is that you yourself are not capable of understanding the scriptures. But here's the reality. The Reformation has a lot of answers and a lot of good things to point out to us. It doesn't have a lot to say about what we're going through in some places in the 21st century. Calvin's not going to help us with the internet. He doesn't have much to say to us about internet pornography, about our kids and their gadgets, about how to raise them in that environment. He doesn't think that way. What we need is a mature Christianity where we have learned from them and we've learned in our context the way to address things. And if we see them as our tribunal, then we actually tend to freeze ourselves in one situation in the past. We were late coming to the global story because we tended to say, no, we needed to care about only right now or only the past. Now we're saying, no, the future has a lot to offer, but that doesn't mean we throw any of this out. Because if they stand shoulder to shoulder with us, then they are with us as to the ends of the age, because they can always point out to us things that we could miss, things that we could forget. And I think, Lord willing, he'll be back by then. But if there's another 500 years, when we're talking about that anniversary, it'll still be, it was important. It is important. But, you know, whatever they're doing then, who knows what that'll be, will be a different situation, a different time that requires the application of the Bible to life. And so therefore, I always say, put them shoulder to shoulder, and that is how you use the Reformation today. Not as if we go back in time, but as if they stand with us as the saints of heaven do throughout all time. Okay. I'm done. So